Welcome to the Mindful Medicina Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jeanette Daniels. I'm a naturopathic medical doctor on a mission to inspire a renewed confidence in the intelligence of the human body. And joining the conversation today is my friend and colleague, Janelle Hartman, lymphatic and colon hydrotherapist, esteemed yoga teacher of teachers, and the co-producer of this show. Welcome back, everybody. Thank you. Thank you for joining us again for another, what is to be another fantastic, inspiring interview. Today we have Dr. Paul Anderson, who is going to go into the differences between HBOT, hyperbaric oxygen treatments and therapy, with IV oxygen / ozone treatments, and just give us a little bit of in-depth information about the differences between them. We are hoping to clarify perhaps like conditions that might perform better with maybe HBOT versus IV EBU, or, you know, who might be contraindicated for each type of therapy. But otherwise, we really hope to really dive deep into oxygen treatments today and have you walk away with a better understanding of those differences. So Dr. Anderson is a recognized educator and clinician in integrative and naturopathic medicine with a focus on complex, infectious, chronic, and oncologic illnesses. In addition to 3 decades worth of clinical experience, he also was head of the interventional arm of a U.S. NIH-funded human research trial using IV and integrative therapies in cancer patients. He founded Advanced Medical Therapies in Seattle, Washington, a clinic focused on cancer and chronic diseases, and now he focuses his time in collaboration with clinics and hospitals in the U.S. and other countries. Some of his former positions include multiple medical school posts, professor of pharmacology and clinical medicine at Bastyr University, and chief of IV services for Bastyr Oncology Research Center. He is a co-author of multiple books entitled Outside the Box Cancer Therapies, Anthology Success Breakthroughs, The Journey of Diagnosis to Empowerment, and he's also co-authored a book entitled A Scientific Reference for Intravenous Nutrient Therapy, which is an IV textbook, which I actually own. It's quite a great resource if any of you naturopaths out there are doing IV treatments. He is a frequent CME speaker and writer and has extended his educational outreach, creating an online CE website entitled consultdra.com. and Advanced Applications in Medical Practice, otherwise known as AAMP conferences. AAMP is dedicated to bringing next-level learning to healthcare professionals to enhance their knowledge and clinical skills in a CME-approved format. We are most grateful for this very, very busy and altruistic man to carve out some time for Mindful Medicina today and for all of our listeners. We hope you enjoy this conversation as much as we did. Welcome, Dr. Anderson. We're so happy to have you today. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Awesome. So today's conversation, we're going to go into the differences between hyperbaric treatments versus IV ozone therapies, since I've had so many patients asking me what the difference was, and I felt that we needed to get the expert in today. So can you give us a little bit of background about who you are and what you're doing these days? Because you've done so much.
Yeah. So I'm a naturopathic physician in Washington State, and I've been teaching and doing research and things in the naturopathic and integrative world for 30 some years at this point. I've practiced in Oregon, Arizona, and Washington, so I've had clinics all over. Currently, I have a private practice that's very curated. It's half advanced cancer and half advanced chronic illness. And the rest of my time I spend in medical education, teaching other doctors and healthcare providers. So that's the short version, but that's what I'm up to these days.
Awesome. Yeah,
Great.
you've given so much to the naturopathic medical world. We just thank you so much. So without further ado, I thought it would be really great if we can go into what oxidative therapies are and how they work, in general, before we get into specific types of therapies that are considered oxidative.
Yeah, that's a great place to
Like
start.
what is oxidation? What is it doing?
So I think the first thing, and some people seem to understand this, but I think a lot of people don't, is the human body would not be alive without oxidation. We do our own natural oxidation all the time. And so we have a system called redox, which is reduction and oxidation, and they balance each other out. It's a very yin and yang sort of biochemical thing. For example, if you could not create your own oxidation through white blood cells and other enzymes and stuff, you would never have a proper immune response and you'd be dead already, died as an infant. So the beginning of every immune response is an oxidative burst, for example. There's other things, like there's local white blood cell and other immune cells that will take advantage of oxidative activity if the components are there for it. So I think it's important for people to know that this is part of the way our bodies work. Now, normally, even if, let's say, you have an infection and your body goes into upswing of oxidation, your body also then has feedback that says, well, okay, we've done enough of that and we'll go back down. And that's when you do the reductive part, which is the antioxidant part. So when we take a step back then and go outside of the body and do a therapy, there's a lot of therapies that are in the oxidative family, you could say. They all work slightly differently, but what they're trying to do is to accentuate this natural process that we already have. And there's different ways to accentuate it. And that makes some of the differences between the different, therapies that we're going to talk about. So oxidation's part of how we maintain our body, part of how our immune system works. It also has a compensatory antioxidant or reductive portion that becomes very important, especially in certain, especially chronic illnesses. And we can talk about that. And so then when we do an oxidative treatment on the outside of the body, or maybe introduce it to the inside like ozone, we need to remember that we're pushing that process faster. And that's then that gives us what our targets are as far as do I want to do more of this or is that enough, et cetera.
Okay. So as far as so oxidation, would that is that going into accepting electrons? Is this a electron conversation?
At its base, oxidation and reduction are the acceptance and removal of electrons. And generally, there's a balance, though. So you don't want to leave somebody in a totally reduced or totally oxidized state because the tissue would break down. But the accepting and release of electrons then will trigger different processes in the body. So you could have like a Fenton reaction, which is a oxidative burst reaction. You can have other reactions that are similar. And so the electrons are sort of the currency. But what really is important is what is the oxidative, let's call it an oxidative burst or rise that the therapy does. What does that do downstream from the electron movement and the reactions and all of that business? That's really where any health promoting or medicinal sort of properties come about.
Okay, so are there any ways to test if somebody has too much oxidative stress? What would that look like? Are there labs for that before we implement an oxidative therapy?
Not great. There are research labs that are done that are not clinically available or relevant, where you can measure these things, and that's how most redox science and research is done. There's not a lot of great primary markers that you can do with patients easily. Now, if you take a step back and you're working in the chronic illness or the cancer spectrum, but chronic illness, when we see people having a lot of extra oxidation and maybe some mitochondrial damage, et cetera, we'll start to see some soft markers change. So their LDH, their lactate dehydrogenase, will start to rise. And if you check that on lots of chronically ill people, you see you'll often find elevations in LDH that you wouldn't see in a healthy population. And that doesn't mean necessarily that they are a bad candidate for oxidation. It means you have to go a little more carefully with folks like that, because their body's sort of already tipping over to the more oxidized and kind of angry side. There's some next level testing you can do in regard to lipid panels, not like cholesterol, but actual like phospholipid panels and things. Sometimes in those you can see an oxidative state or not. And then there's there are more disease state tests that would say, oh, this is a person who's really struggling. People with high mycotoxins from mold, for example, you see this. People with a lot of very active chronic infections, you'll see this sort of thing.
Okay. Yeah, I do know that for receiving high dose vitamin C or ascorbic acid and doing the EBU, we do need to check the G6PD, which would imply that they would actually have a sensitivity or hemolytic anemia to the oxidative treatments. So that's the only marker that I'm aware of that would
Yeah, and that's not
preclude.
really a marker of oxidation. That's just they're missing an enzyme
That's
that would
right.
keep them safe during the procedure. So that's a safety thing. It's sort of like checking kidney function. That's a safety thing that is only related to that. Now, if you were to give somebody, chloroquine or something like that, which is an oxidative drug, those G6PD people will also be damaged from that. But yeah, that's more of a propensity. You could also say people with thalassemias, blood cell problems, they don't oxidize very well, et cetera. But those are really more, is it really appropriate for this person or not? The more tough clinical questions are, is the person who has no G6PD or thalassemia or whatever sitting in front of me going to tolerate me doing ozone with them or, some other thing? Yeah.
Okay. So, as far as oxidation goes, could you explain to us a little bit about gamma? When we're talking about ozone treatments, they're delivered at different levels of gamma. Is there a way to simplify understanding gamma dose? Because I'll have a patient who will see that Ibu has a delivers 3 gamma. And then the 10 pass is going to be 50 plus. And so they're thinking, oh, 3 gamma's weak, 50 must be stronger.
Can I have and sort of quick
Yeah.
question? Gamma
Yeah.
sounds to
It's the
me context of,
concentration.
sounds like a measurement of, so yeah, that's the concentration of what you're
Concentration.
administering. Okay, got it.
So just to make it, especially patients considering this sort of thing, in kind of in modern times, you're supposed to get away from using the term gamma because it's sort of a it's a way to try and characterize the fact that you can have three syringes with the same volume but different concentrations of ozone, say, or whatever you put in there. But what gamma really is trying to say is a dose, which is a concentration dose. So if you have a let's say you have a 30 gamma, right? That's going to equal 30 micrograms of dose of ozone, mm-hmm. right? So then it's how much of those units, you know, how much of those 30 microgram units are we going to stack up and put through the person? So while, and you see this with a spectrum of like, if you're doing, let's say major autohemotherapy where you're mixing it with the blood and all that, you may be on, you know, higher gamma numbers or micrograms. Mm-hmm. If you're doing EBU, you may be on lower, but there's a lot of other things going on with EBU where you don't want, you know, that much oxidation. And then if you're doing like an external, like insufflation or something like that, you're going to be somewhere in the middle. So a lot of it is more is not better. It's how is that gamma being used, or how are those, you know, micrograms per milliliter being used? And the system therein is completely different. So if you take major autohemotherapy, where you take blood out of the person and ozonate it and put it back in, which we do a lot as sort of a initial treatment with people with, you know, infections and cancer, kind of see how they tolerate ozone. That is external and then goes back into the blood. The ozone dose can be higher there because the reactions are occurring within the blood, and then the cytokines from the reactions are going to go back in the patient. There's almost no ozone activity once it goes back in the patient. Okay. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you have a continuous loop with EBU going on and you've got a filtration and all that, you are not, although the blood does leave the body temporarily, go through the filters and come back, you're not doing this sort of one arm's length away treatment like you do with MAH and taking the blood out of the person, you know. And so you don't want as much dose going through there because it's going to go right back into the person. You want a sort of a steady lower dose that is going on mm-hmm. throughout the treatment.
Yeah.
But if you look at the volumes of a patient says, well, I did MAH and it didn't seem to be that bad or whatever, and then they go and do EBU, you look at the volume of turnover of blood, major autohemotherapy is very small compared to what an EBU circuit is going to run through. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where, you know, we kind of have the idea like more is better, but really it's how many micrograms am I putting through the person and with what technology am I doing right. that? They're very different.
Yeah. And then the difference between it going into the blood versus direct contact with tissue. So there's also that too. And I know that, yeah, some people can be really sensitive to ozone in the tissues, be it ear, you know, insufflation or vaginal insufflation. And so everybody responds differently. But yeah, just I always prefer to go low dose first to see how people do because, you know, everyone is a zebra or a unicorn, right? So, but yeah, so going back to what you're saying on the EBU, yeah, I mean, we're ozonating 2 liters of blood
right.
relative to, you know, MAH, right? So it's a lot more blood. And is it safe to say that you might stand to have more of a Herxheimer reaction if you were to have a higher dose with the EBU because you are treating more blood?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So if people kind of visualize it, it's like if you take a, you know, a teacup, that would be like MAH. And then you take a, you know, a bucket, that would be more like EBU. Mm-hmm. So you think of the amount of blood that you're treating over a longer period of time with the bucket. We don't want to be giving you, you know, 30 or 40 micrograms, you know, per unit of time, because you would be much more likely to have just either Herxheimer or just oxidative excess reactions, which mm-hmm. look very, very similar. Mm-hmm. And so that's why the numbers are not analogous. You know, it's like a Mack truck driving and, you know, in a little Volkswagen or something. It's just two different uses of the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
And yeah. then, yeah, insufflation and limb bagging and, you know, all those things.
Right.
I completely agree with your statement of you always want to start low because you never know how, you know, what a person has below the surface. So they might have a lot of, you know, a lot of the wrong bacteria or other infections, or they may just be super sensitive. And it's better to find that out with a lower dose and work them up as opposed to blow them out of the water and then try to explain why they got so sick from, you know, whatever you just did.
Right.
And I think that applies to everything, you know, starting with a test dose, especially in chronically ill people, because you don't know what they're bringing to the table. You know, we know some, but there's a lot below the surface that, you know, can't be done. And then I'm sure you've seen some of my most sensitive patients have responded the best to, you know, maybe external ozone or insufflations and stuff. It's just you want to let their body prove that to you before you go and do a bunch of it.
Sure. Yeah. I've never seen a pattern of, oh, this kind of patient is going to respond really well to high versus low dose. Yeah. And so you just want one at a time. So what sort of, ailments are we treating with IV ozone? What is it good for treating or mitigating? I mean, you had mentioned mold. Can you give us a list of conditions or microbes that really don't like IV ozone, if you will?
Yeah. So I think when you get to the intravenous types of treatments, whether you're doing, you know, a smaller treatment like MAH or a bigger treatment like EBU, or something in the middle like ozonated saline or something. When you're doing those things, they're all going to have an effect on pretty much every type of microbial infection that shouldn't be there. So whether it's something living like a parasite or a virus, or excuse me, a bacteria, or not living like a virus, they're all going to be bothered, maybe in different ways, but they're all going to be bothered by the ozone being there. And this, in the infection side, it kind of goes back to what we said initially, is we are driving extra of a natural process that should go on when you have an infection. And when in chronic infections, usually there's something sidelining your immune system and it kind of loses its way. So I find that for, you know, and we get people have chronic infections where you don't know how many they have. You know, I'll tell patients, like, for every one infection we can identify with a lab, you probably got eight others that we don't even know the name of, and they're just as bad. You know, so you can't get too hung up on, oh, I only have one infection. That's never true. But basically, yes, you're going to do that. Now, if you have intracellular organisms or viruses, so it could be like, you know, the chlamydia family likes the inside of the cell, and viruses only like the inside of the cell, pretty much. The process the ozone's going to drive is going to be a little different than, say, a bacteria that's outside of the cell, where the immune cells can get directly to it. But all that being said, any oxidative therapy, the real immune magic is that the ozonation or the oxidation is there and gone very, very rapidly. It's not sitting around and being ozone or being extra oxygen. What happens is the oxidative burst goes on, and then your body naturally kicks out pro-immune and inflammatory enzymes, and they tell the immune cells to do more work. So the ozone is really just a trigger, right? So if you do, you know, you do upstream oxidative therapies like high dose vitamin C, that occurs, and it's a pro ozone drug that triggers ozone, but really it winds up with the same enzymes and immune triggers that ozone does. They just do it in two different kind of pathways to get there.
Okay. So would, in that case, are there instances where there's, since they're a pro-inflammatory situation, right, you're stimulating the immune system, could people feel more inflamed after an oxidative treatment?
Yeah, and that's, I would say that's the majority of reasons people react with ozone, especially if you go too high too fast. You don't know what is beneath the surface, and if I cause a lot of oxidative burst and your immune system gets really busy and there's a whole lot to deal with, you really are going to feel sick because it's dealing with a bunch. The other one where you have to be a little careful is if they have a uncontrolled or unmanaged autoimmunity, people with unmanaged autoimmunity do not oxidize very well. Now, if their autoimmunity is very well managed and, you know, it's stable, maybe no problem. And we do a lot of, you know, oxidative therapies with autoimmune folks for their co-infections and stuff like that. But if you take somebody that's just got autoimmunity kind of run amok, and you oxidize them, it's going to push them more in their kind of autoimmune side of the immune ledger. Yeah.
So would that sort of be an MS or ALS? Those cases might not be great at handling the...
In the beginning of the case, it's where you, if you were going to do like an ozone type treatment, you'd start really low and just kind of see how they respond. You could also see it with some of, like, you know, Crohn's and colitis are autoimmune, but they're in the gut. Really any other autoimmunity. Yeah. But when we talk about chronically ill folks, sometimes they have autoimmunity, but it's being treated and managed and the immune system is not very reactive. Those people do fine with ozone.
How about for the GI stuff? You had just mentioned the Crohn's, ulcerative colitis. Would those fare better to just go directly into doing rectal insufflation or IV? What would be more beneficial?
You know, it depends a bit on what else is wrong. Meaning a lot of times people with Crohn's or colitis will also have a lot of microbial load that is, you know, not helping them. I have seen, and like you said earlier, there's not a pattern really that you see. I've seen people where like rectal insufflations were just the thing and it didn't blow them out of the water, made them feel a lot better. And then I've seen people where that was sort of like, you know, and we did more of a systemic treatment and they felt better with it. But, you know, I suppose one of the things about rectal insufflation is, especially if they would have, you know, colitis that had a microbial component, which it does, often that can be helpful as long as you're not real flared up when you do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my cat was sick about a year ago, really bad loose stools. Just we had to let her go. She had something going on, but they didn't quite understand, but sort of presented with as an ulcerative colitis situation or Crohn's, and they gave her steroids, etc., and it helped a little bit to make her stools solid and de-inflame her, if you will. And but you know, I started to do the ozone insufflation on her, and wow, that really, she did really well on that for quite a while. That bought us a little bit of time. So just a case where I actually used it on my cat. So she wasn't my friend after that.
Yeah, I'm sure the cat probably wondered about what was happening.
What in the heck is she doing? Anyways, so I have a lot of patients who are wondering. There's a waste bucket with the EBU, and they're always wondering what's in it. To date, the only thing I know is that it has fibrinogen and urea in there, and the fibrinogen from the heparin that we use to keep the lines from clotting. So, but there's a lot of Instagram folks out there trying to sell that the EBU's producing X waste, right? Heavy metals, etc. Is there any way to know for certain what the EBU treatments would be pulling out into the waste bucket? I can't seem to find a clear answer on that. But I don't want to sell patients on something that's not proven or true. So I do know for a fact fibrinogen because of the heparin and the uric acid. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so there's going to be a couple levels to the answer, probably. With filtration-type procedures like EBU, the waste has, you know, those things that we know, like fibrinogen and, you know, uric acid. Mm-hmm. And then anything that might be attached to them. Mm-hmm. So you, and there have, no one's really published much yet, but there have been people who've looked at those and like run, are there metals in there? Are there mycotoxins or whatever? Mm-hmm. And there are some toxins that can go out that way. It's not very predictable, but they can. Mm-hmm. The filter They're doing more work looking at what gets trapped in the filter.
Right.
And you get a lot of, you can get bacterial toxins caught in the filter, which is a good thing to get rid of.
Yeah.
You can have spike protein caught in the filter. That's been established now.
Mm-hmm.
And other things that are in that size range can go out there. But I think, you know, it's always better to, you know, not promise something you really don't know is happening or not.
Right.
You know, you can kind of say mechanistically, we know that this size of thing gets stuck in the filters that could help with spike protein reactions and stuff. And we know that there can be some things that stick to the fibrinogen that's leaving because it's a large molecule that other junk will, you know, attach mm-hmm. itself to. But it's not as well studied as like apheresis, where we know almost exactly everything that comes out in an apheresis procedure. Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay. And then mentioning spike proteins, do we find that the EBU filtration system is helping with long COVID patients or patients who've been identified to have microclotting issues going on?
Yeah, I think that in regard to, you know, long COVID, there's obviously a lot of other things that have to be addressed. But as a general treatment that's helpful on an immune level and also filtering some available spike protein and then triggering maybe a little bit more of a better return to immune function, EBU is a very useful tool in people with long COVID. There's other things, of course, that have to be attended to because you can never, you can't like vacuum the spike protein out of them. You only get what you can get. Mm-hmm. So you have to do things to break spike down, you know, like natokinase or other enzyme therapies. You have to block the spike uptake,
mm-hmm.
Which a lot of herbs do actually in the research, curcumin and quercetin and stuff like that can help. But there's also like lowering the load and helping the person to be able to use their own recuperative powers. Well, if they have like real high spike levels, doing EBU in a series can lower what they're dealing with, so then the body can kind of fight back better.
Mm-hmm.
So I've referred a lot of folks, you know, there's other treatments too, but I've referred a lot of people if they're going to do an intervention, let's try EBU first because it's fairly available and mm-hmm. It's a safe and useful treatment. Yeah.
Yeah. And the EBU has the full spectrum UV light. Can you go into a little bit about the benefit of the blood running through the UV light source?
Yeah. So in addition to the ozonization with, you know, using the low microgram or low gamma dose ozone, you also have a direct contact with the UVBI, UV blood radiation. Now, UVBI's research goes back well over 100 years, but the last, you know, 40 or 50 years has seen a lot more of the modern use of it. There's a couple of things that UV does. So the blood, you have kind of two major compartments. One's your plasma, which has maybe some enzymes in it, but it's clear-ish. And then you have your cells, platelets, and the red and white blood cells. The UV actually activates a lot of the enzymes that are used by the immune system that are floating around in the plasma, and also certain enzymes that are working inside of the red blood cells and some of the white blood cells. So it's sort of like you get the ozone triggers that oxidative thing we talked about earlier. Then the UVBI actually turns on a more activation of, let's say, remember earlier we talked about ozone triggering immune enzymes to increase and stuff. The UV can actually then make those work harder. So it's sort of an augment that goes along.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like the sun stimulates the immune system in general.
Yeah. This this is just right on the blood.
Yeah. Especially if you live in Seattle,
And you don't see the sun that much.
That's right. Yeah. High latitude, right? 47 north latitude. Yeah. Have fun with that. Welcome, MS. Okay. So then it sounds like we pretty much covered the IV ozone part here. And then what I wanted to do is to contrast that with the hyperbaric oxygen. And you had mentioned that the ozone quickly breaks down into the blood, into other constituents. Because we have to always say this, people get nervous about ozone, right? Like, oh, isn't that, right. Yeah. Is that dangerous? You're not really actually getting the ozone when it's all said and done. So moving forward into the hyperbaric, this is something that I don't offer in clinic. And so whenever a patient asks me about it, I've been waiting to talk to you. So could you tell us what hyperbaric is and how it works as an oxygen delivery system?
Yeah. So, and I think because patients will pick up on this because of the magic of the internet. There's some, I call it kind of confusing training that goes on, kind of equating ozone therapy and hyperbaric oxygen therapy, and almost saying that, you know, one could replace the other, like they're redundant or something like that. And that's not a very true statement, number one. They're both very useful. They just kind of do different things. And there's versatility with both of them, and they can be used together also. And we do this a lot. So just keeping in mind, they're kind of two different things. Mm-hmm. When you're looking at using gases like oxygen in a medical way, so I'm going to drive ozone to drive all the stuff we just talked about, or I'm going to increase gas pressure in a person by using hyperbaric oxygen, which is going to increase multiple gases, not just oxygen. You have three components you have to consider that are like the prescription. This is what makes the therapy work. In hyperbaric, you have pressure and then the gas mixture and then the time of administration. In ozone therapy, you have a known gas, being the oxygen that the ozone's going to donate. And then you have concentration. We talked about gamma, micrograms per mil, all of that business, and time, but you don't have the pressure component. The pressure component is not an inert thing. The pressure on its own, and this is one of the problems with hyperbaric and what people believe about it, is that a large portion of hyperbaric science was based on dive medicine and dive accidents. So you're using very high doses of oxygen or very high pressure to bring someone from the bottom up and keep them alive, right? That skewed a lot of the research. So for example, up until 2012, everybody thought hyperbaric oxygen would make cancer worse. Since 2012, all of the publications, of which there's, you know, about 80, show that no, it's actually helpful to cancer, because cancer behaves differently with hyperbaric. The other thing that is also was just never studied before was, you have to have very high pressures and pure oxygen or very high concentration of oxygen to do anything, or hyperbaric won't work. Well, that was just because no one ever looked at anything else. Now, when we look at lower pressures that are a little easier on the body, sort of like the EBU model, and mixed gas, which is becoming much more popular nowadays, where you have a little higher oxygen, but you're getting nitrogen and the other stuff too. Those, for example, we used to believe you could only get stem cell activation with high pressure, high oxygen. Now we know we can do it with low pressure and moderate oxygen, but no one ever studied it. Mm-hmm. So in the last 7 years, all of hyperbaric science has been turned on its head. So a lot of people believe a lot of really weird stuff about it because they have 30-year-old memories, apparently. Right. So What you have to think about with hyperbaric is, because the pressure is its own physical force, and the pressure not only drives oxygen in to saturate the plasma, which is kind of the magic of the oxygen delivery, because your hemoglobin saturates really rapidly, but the plasma carries normally, what, 3% of oxygen? In hyperbaric, it can go up, you know, to very, very high numbers, you know, okay, high double digits. So that delivers the oxygen to your tissues. But the pressure also is an epigenetic trigger. It turns on enzymes that your body has suppressed, and it will do other things in a non-oxidative way. So there's like pressure is a thing. So what I'm trying to tell people, yes, ozone and hyperbaric are both using oxygen to manipulate your system. That's true. Ozone just does it differently, and then hyperbaric does it with the addition of pressure medicine, pressure and gas medicine, which is very different from ozone. Mm-hmm. So people will often, where they are similar is if you don't know how maybe sick a person is or something, or if somebody has like a lot of infections that are totally untreated, and you put them in hyperbaric and you go too much pressure too quickly, it's just like giving too much ozone too quickly.
Got it.
They'll herx and they'll have troubles and stuff. So with people, we're not sure what's going on. We start with lower pressure and shorter dives and just make sure it's cool. That being said, if people don't have those things going, they're not that sensitive, you can do more rather quickly. Like we do it a lot with people who have had nerves cut in surgery and they need neuroregeneration, or they just hit their head and they need a TBI protocol. Those folks will tolerate a lot more, a lot faster. And we will also sequence them. So we'll do a dive, a hyperbaric, and then do ozone after.
Okay.
And a really cool thing with hyperbaric, I have a wonderful drawing I made for people so they see it, but is you can manipulate hyperbaric by what you give after the dive. Yeah, you don't have to give anything if you don't want to.
Yeah.
But if you consider it, hyperbaric kind of has that same as ozone, the upswing of oxidation, mm-hmm, you know, right after your dive, you're full of oxygen and all that, and then it goes away. Mm-hmm. And then there's a downswing that triggers the reductive or the antioxidant system to turn on. Okay. So it sort of pushes that natural up and downswing of my immune system to complete the cycle faster,
okay,
which is why it's so good for repair. If I am concerned that you've got, like, I know you're tolerant of oxidative therapies, and I know you've got a bunch of infections, I'll put you in the chamber, we'll do a dive, and we'll do ozone right after to trigger the oxidation to go even higher. So it pushes the up curve longer, and so they get more oxidant treatment to attack, let the immune system attack the bugs. Yeah. If, on the other hand, you don't have infections and you're like, you've got a bad traumatic brain injury or a nerve injury or something, I'll put you in the chamber. We'll let the oxidant curve go up. I'll take you out. We'll give you an antioxidant type intravenous treatment, and we'll force the down slope to go longer so that you get the recuperative part. You're already inflamed enough.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so you can manipulate in that way. And that's a unique thing with hyperbaric because of what it does. You don't want to do those sort of things generally with ozone because it's doing its own thing.
Okay. Yeah. So then you had mentioned nerve damage. So how is that helping with nerve regeneration or nerve repair, or is it just de-inflaming said nerves? Is it actually creating a repairing process?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I've had too many clinics, but one of them in your neighborhood where we used to have the big hyperbaric,
yes,
center, across Interstate 5 was a bunch of oral surgeons, and every now and then in oral surgery you can't avoid cutting a nerve in half or something, And these were generally healthier folks, but they didn't like the nerve being cut. And so in plastic surgery, in orthopedics, and in oral surgery, they're all very aware of the power of hyperbaric oxygen for nerve repair and, wow, you know, helping someone with a bad surgery outcome. So we got a ton of patients that were just there to repair, you know, transected nerves in their jaw. And it really speeds up the neuroregeneration. So because you have the pressure component, and because you're not just oxidizing the person with hyperbaric, you have the pressure and the movement of gas, and you're doing this upswing and then downswing, the saying sort of goes that, you know, hyperbaric is indicated for a wound of any kind in any location in the body. Wow. So it's a wound healing modality. That's pretty much what it's always been outside of for dive accidents. Okay. The way it does it is, yes, by delivering, you know, oxygen to the tissues and doing all this cool stuff. And now we know, this is more modern research, the pressure turning on healing enzymes through epigenetic signaling. But the other thing is, it actually forces that sine wave of oxidation and antioxidant, which forces the immune system, which is the thing that's going to repair a nerve or repair your torn muscle or whatever, to do it faster. And it takes the repair fatigue out. So if you go and you get a big injury, your body tries to do natural processes to heal it up, and it develops repair fatigue because it can only like heal so much at a time. Hyperbaric takes and resets the clock on the repair processes. So that's why, to the best of our knowledge right now, that's why it's so good at wound healing and nerve healing and stuff like that.
And this is totally accepted in hospitals in the burn unit. That's right. What you can get insurance to cover often is with bad burns.
Burns and certain diabetic complications,
concussions,
and then, you know, certain it tends to be more like an elderly person getting an orthopedic surgery that kind of doesn't go so well. There's certain approved, you know, there's like 13 approved purposes, and it's ungodly expensive in the hospital, but it gets paid for. And you know why there's not more approved things is a government discussion.
It really is fascinating that it's like many forms of just decentralized natural medicine. When you add oxygen, the cells function better. So it's almost like there's really nothing that it won't improve. I mean, you just, it's the building block that's needed.
Well, now I'm wondering, since, so I had an episode of pulpitis, and oh my God. So that was probably one of the worst pains I've experienced. And I'm wondering, would that actually benefit case of pulpitis, which, you know, or any of these neurological pains, any of the nerve pains in the mouth or in the head, trigeminalgia, whatever, it's would that be great?
A lot of globally bad surgical outcomes are generally very well treated, you know, by hyperbaric. The things that we've done, I think just because we had proximity to the oral surgery folks, you see a lot of these, like, you know, dry sockets and pulpitis and all these horribly painful things. It is almost universally helpful. I think partly because the jaw and the gums are so superficial, you know, and you can get in there rather quickly. I think those are almost always supported by hyperbaric.
And is there a timeline of which hyperbaric wouldn't really do much if the injury's, say, you know, 20 years old? Does it matter how quickly you get in, or is it evident that hyperbaric can work even on a really old injury?
It will still help, like many other treatments. The longer you are from the actual injury, though, the longer it'll take to make a change and the less amplitude of change it will have. So for example, in people with post-radiation neuropathies or nerve damage, which is something that I've done research with in humans, if we get them in the first 6 months after the damage,
okay,
and we do this little sine wave augmentation with hyperbaric and then the nutrient and glutathione thing, they'll heal much more rapidly and they'll come, you can get them to complete recovery. If you go 6 months to 2 years, still can get a lot of work done. And you might get, 75, 80% recovery. You get past 2 to 5 years, depending on the person, and you can help, especially like we see this with chronic traumatic encephalopathies and old brain injuries and stuff. You can still help. It's just, it's an older wound. And so there's less to heal.
And are there any contraindications or population sample that would not be able to get the hyperbaric treatments?
Yeah, there's a small but important group of things. Anybody who has either sinus or inner ear dysfunction that can't be compensated for. So if your sinuses are full, but we give you a nasal spray to open them, that's compensating and you're not going to have a problem there, right? If your eardrums are, retracted on one side and stuck, you don't want to be pressurizing that person's head until you get the eustachian tubes open and moving. So, you have to think about those things. Somebody with, like a pneumothorax, that would not be good. And there's a couple of other things. There's a few drugs that have a theoretical issue. Most of them are chemotherapy drugs, where you wouldn't want to overoxidate because they're an oxidant drug and the concern is too much. But those are not, that's not like every, it's a small number of drugs that are worried about there. And then there's, a couple of very rare blood problems. Interestingly, not G6PD. That's okay. Not one of them. That's a very common one. But there's a couple of, blood dyscrasias that almost never happen. Okay. But those would be a contraindication. So those should be like, they're on our checklist with people to go through, are you on these three chemos? Are you, should we check your ears? How are your sinuses? All of that stuff.
I got a little. Generally, I was going to say, I just have a lighter one to add. Because I can feel our listeners already thinking about this. I'm claustrophobic.
Yes.
Yeah. The more self-selected one.
Yeah.
Like that's, that comes up for folks.
I 100%. Yeah. And claustrophobia is very person dependent. So I'm fairly claustrophobic myself, and I've done a lot of hyperbaric, and there are different chambers where there are chambers where I feel great. Like, cause you can't tell on Zoom, but I'm a tall, big person. If I can put my arms out and feel like I have elbow room, I'm much more likely to be happy. Mm-hmm. We also, in one of the clinics, we have an upright chamber where you're sitting. It's like you're in an upright tube, okay, but it's very big. Mm-hmm. You're in a chair. It's like you're in your office. So those are less of a problem. Mm-hmm. I've gotten in some where I feel like I'm very close, to the glass and stuff. And it like one time I just couldn't do it. So that's something that if you are claustrophobic, meet with the people who do the hyperbaric and have them let you get in and feel it and do all that stuff. Cause sometimes it's very doable and sometimes just the geometry is not good for you.
I'd like to say, I have a lot of experience with hyperbaric. For about a year and a half, like almost every single week, sometimes twice, I would get treatments. And I'm like a cat. I love enclosed spaces. So it wasn't an issue, but I did ask about, like, what about folks that, I've mentioned it to people and that's the first thing out of their mouth. And they said, a lot of times claustrophobia, it could just be organically, you just feel that way, but there's maybe been a trauma But it's really the brain reacting to a enclosed space with not a lot of oxygen. So this is actually the opposite. And they said they find that a lot of people, it almost heals their claustrophobia, at least when they're in the chamber, because they are having, there's a lot of oxygen in there, even though the space is enclosed.
Yeah, it's, that's been my personal experience, is you feel so much better. Once the chamber pressurizes and the oxygen's going, it's like you feel brighter almost immediately.
Yeah.
And it makes you calm down.
That's it.
You know, so if you can get past the initial, you know, thing of that, that is true. What they said is what I've experienced also. And it's also, you know, I've had a lot of hyperbaric also for different reasons. And I noticed I had it was 2 years ago, I had a bad concussion. And right after the head injury, I was much more sensitive to the claustrophobia because I had a head injury and my nervous system was just, you know, kind of all buggy. But then once I would get in and I would feel like, oh, I can start to think again, you know, it's like, oh, it's like your brain saying, no, this is a good place. We're good.
It's very it's parasympathetic. I would always joke that I had my Maui nap. I would happy. I'd fall asleep. And then it was just like, oh, I've been on the beach.
Yeah. It's sort of, you're sort of getting a reward or, know, some sort of positive payoff. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, your perception of a change is like anything else in life. Mm-hmm. So, how long are the sessions typically? What's the minimum time that someone would be in?
Yeah. So, normally you calculate it by what they call bottom time. So there's a certain number of minutes to get to pressure and then a certain number to come up, and those, you know, count really. Our test doses for people where we want to really make sure all is well, let's say they're a very complicated Lyme patient or something, we might just do 30 minutes of bottom time, you know, as a test dose. That's, you get some benefit, but that's pretty short. Okay. The average are 60 to 90 minutes, depending on what gas mix and all of the other stuff. And you can do longer, depending, you know, on what's wrong with you. But the median is 60 to 90 minutes at depth. And then, you know, people will ask, well, you know, cause a lot of the protocols for non-dive injury are for, you know, brain trauma, chronic encephalopathy. Those folks had to do 4 or 5 days a week, every week, you know, for 40 to 80 treatments, right? Mm-hmm. But for other stuff, like our surgery folks or whatever, we would say, you know, can you come in 3 times a week in the beginning? You know, if we get a fresh head injury, like off a car accident, we've looked at this, you know, just in numbers of and outcomes, it is better if you have a fresh injury you're dealing with, especially brain injury, if you can do 4 or 5 days a week the first couple of weeks and get the ball rolling, and then you can do, you know, a little bit less. Mm-hmm. In other therapeutic things, though, like we talked about, you could either maybe do an ozone treatment after to keep the oxidative party going. We do that, you know, infectious patients, cancer patients. We may only do that once a week. Because that's sort of a different outcome we're looking for. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not wound healing. It's driving an oxidative event. And you may only want to do that once a week. A lot of it is just clinically determined.
Mm-hmm. And then you've talked about, like, these are things that are preceding an event or something that we're treating. But in your book, amazing book, by the way, Cancer, The Journey of Diagnosis to Empowerment, about preceding hyperbaric before, like chemotherapy as an example.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's just, I like the idea of the preceding aspect as well.
Yeah, you can synergize radiation therapy if you're having it by doing a chamber run right before you go and do your radiation. You can, depending on the type of chemotherapy, you can either just improve the status of your redox and all that, so the chemo goes in and does a better job. You can use hyperbaric and other things to augment, you know, the activity of lots of drugs.
So is there a typical response that people have that they can expect, maybe say the day after doing a treatment? What might someone clinically experience?
Well, it really depends a lot, because a lot like with ozone, where one person, it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm felt nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the next person, it's like they're disordered for 3 days. You know, it's like, it depends a lot what's going on. If you have a fresh injury, especially like a brain injury, you will feel different in the chamber.
Wow.
Like once you reach pressure a few minutes in, you will start to feel like there's a fog lifting and your brain's working again. So, you know, it's a little bit dependent on stuff like that. Have occasionally, and I think you had mentioned also the Maui nap, people tend to go one way or the other, and this is more of a genetic individuality. Some people fall asleep immediately when they get in the chamber. And that's just their pattern, and they feel so much better, you know, when they wake up and get out. Other people, it's a little stimulating, you know, because of all the oxygen and everything.
Right.
So it's like we said earlier, it's not one pattern of how people feel.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that, you know, the brain injury stuff, you feel it very quickly. A lot of our people post-surgery where they transected nerves or other jaw problems, you know, in the first week, they would start to feel like things were happening and they were, you know, they were starting to heal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If it's more of a therapeutic thing, like we talked about with giving, you know, hyperbaric and then ozone to drive some oxidation, the only thing we're concerned about there is that they don't feel too oxidized the next day, you know, mm-hmm. and inflamed and stuff. But mm-hmm. they'll do fine.
So with that said, do you, and one last question to just round everything out, with the IV ozone treatments, I'm using binders with my patients. Is binding something that is recommended post hyperbaric treatments?
Yeah, it depends a bit on what the underlying issues are. With ozone, because you're kind of driving a more acute immune reaction, which can then cause the body to dump things, you know, rather rapidly. You know, you definitely want to have binders around because you never know what people are going to release or what bugs are going to die or whatever. With hyperbaric, it depends a lot what you come to hyperbaric with. So if someone has mycotoxins from mold toxicity, hyperbaric very definitely pushes things through the cell, including mycotoxins. So you want to make sure you have binders for that. If you're chemically toxic, it'll kind of push more chemicals out. Mm-hmm. And then if you have a lot of infections, just like you'd be cautious with ozone, and you're doing hyperbaric, the immune system may get very busy. And again, when infections die, there's a lot of toxic material that the infectious agent will release too. And that's a case for binders as well. Yeah.
And would you recommend sweating or saunas post any oxidation therapy, actually?
Yeah, I mean, I think they all can be synergistic with one another. Most people will, especially if they're having a mild to moderate reaction like Herxing or something like it, generally sauna will make that a lot better. And a lot of it is just it's keeping the toxins moving on their way out of the body. Right. So sauna can be very helpful. The other thing that can be very helpful of people that are very toxic is timing colonic therapy with their oxidative therapies, because the body will sort of, you know, hold on to things and they'll feel better when they get rid of it. That's another really, really good synergist, although you would do that less often than sauna, but yeah.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And Janelle's a great source for a great colonic at Vessel. You'll find her in Edmonds. So tell us, how can people find you for your offerings? What do you tell us how we can find you and pick your brain more?
So I have lots and lots of Paul entities online. So there's a very big YouTube channel that's all health education, and I've got some patient education and some doctor education stuff. So what I did is I just made a hub website where all the links are, and it's simple. It's dranow.com, so dranow.com.
Oh, great.
And the links to YouTube and the books and practitioner site, it's all there.
Awesome. Okay, great, great. We'll definitely put that in the show notes. And also, we want to have you back. We have a couple other topics we want to chat with you about. We know you're busy as can be. So, won't bug you too soon. But thank you so much for clarifying those oxidative treatments for me. I really, really appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was fun.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We hope this conversation has empowered you. Remember, you are unique and you are a miracle. Your body doesn't make mistakes. It responds perfectly to an imperfect environment. Until next time, go get that life.